please the court, my name is Gary Proctor, and I represent Jason Reynolds in this matter. I plan to primarily talk today about the aggravated identity theft and whether Mr. Reynolds could properly have been convicted of that. If there's time, I thought someone spoke. If there's time, I'd like to move on to the 403, 404B, and I would be content to submit on briefs the third issue, the hearsay that was admitted at trial. This issue is an issue of first impression in the circuit. I do not believe there's a case on point as to whether the identity theft statute requires, in fact, a theft. I'll concede right off the bat, the other circuits are pretty foursquarely against me on this, but there are some interesting issues. What happened, the factual basis, is Mr. Reynolds submitted a corporate resolution with the signature of four directors. Each of which the directors said that they didn't give him authority to do that.
So he used, without authority, someone else's name.
Or other people's names, yes.
Okay. And that's, the statute talks about uses.
Well,
without lawful authority. It seems, even if this wasn't the example of what Congress had in mind, it's certainly well within the plain language of the statute, don't you think?
We don't. There are several ways in which this case could have come within the statute's ambit, but we submit none of them qualify here. There was no theft. There was no harm.
The statute doesn't speak of theft.
Well, the title of it is aggravated identity theft. The title of the statute when it was introduced was the Identity Theft Penalty Enhancement Act.
The title doesn't control the text. It can be a helpful tool at times, but certainly the text.
And the legislative intent, you know, repairing damaged credit, damaged reputations, people going on spending sprees, leaving a person with damaged credit, the presidential signing statement, running up bills on a credit card can damage lifelong efforts to build and maintain a good credit.
The signing statement is just an example of, again, the typical case you think about, but the language of the statute seems to speak more broadly than that. And here, if I have the facts correct, the defendant used the identities of other people without authority to obtain money from the bank or the church, depending on how you look at it.
Well, identity, again, is kind of an amorphous word. He used
the names.
Signatures, yes. Cut and pasted signatures is what it appears. Again, as part of a corporate resolution. I'll concede, I know next to nothing about corporate law, but these people were directors. You know, they weren't acting because they had no knowledge of it. There was no harm to their personal reputation. There couldn't even be any potential.
Where's the harm requirement and come in? Because there is harm here in this case, obviously harm to the bank or the church.
Right, and the regular identity guidelines more than cover the amount of loss, the harm to the bank, the number of victims.
We're talking here just about the statute.
We are talking about a two-year mandatory minimum on whether, you know, this one kicks in. I mean, the government's position leads to absurd results. If I'd find another case from a circuit that I wanted to cite a supplemental authority last night and I couldn't get my co-counsel on the line and I just submitted a notice of supplemental authority, by the government's rationale, I just committed aggravated identity theft. Use someone's bar card, it's someone's name, it's without their authority.
I mean, you have to use it to aid or abet or in connection with an unlawful activity that constitutes violation of federal law or a felony.
Yeah, and it has to be one of the enumerated felonies.
It does, but still.
So your example actually wouldn't be covered, I don't think.
Again, it's above and beyond the crime. You know, what makes it aggravating?
The absurdity you were talking about, I think, comes in because of how it relates to the guidelines, right?
I mean, the cases around the country,
guidelines are changing constantly, sure. I don't know that that's the... That tail can wag this statutory interpretation.
You know, dead people having their identity stolen. People aiding and abetting in their own identity theft. You know, this is not what the statute was designed to create. This is not what we're looking at here.
What do you mean by aiding and abetting their own identity
theft?
There's
a case, the Sixth Circuit maybe, where someone gave his identity and he himself was convicted of aggravated identity theft because he aided and abetted the stealing of his own identity. You know, it's if we're reaching absurd conclusions where, you know, what the statute was designed to do, what the legislative intent was to protect people that I can't get a car, I can't get a job, I'm having trouble leaving the country because someone else stole my passport or my green card. You know, that's so far removed from this, where it was a signature on a corporate resolution.
And uses without lawful authority a means of identification of another person. There was money taken here without lawful authority. Right?
Correct.
Okay. And it was done by using the names of the other people. That's how the money was accessed, right?
And I would concede, but for, you know, this, why the title of the statute doesn't control, it certainly instructs. You know, there's case law on that. And the one case in this circuit that looked at it, Villanueva Sotelo, albeit in a different context, you know, said theft is precisely what the statute was intended to catch. Here, you know, there's no evidence that anything like that occurred.
Right.
So I don't see it. It's too, you know, there was also no evidence.
How would you steal someone's name as opposed to use it without their authorization? I don't understand what you mean by steal their name.
Well, I agree it's almost a distinction without a difference, but if you look at, like, state underlying laws, there's you can steal a car and you can make the unauthorized use of a car. Mm-hmm. You know, every state I know of has the difference. You know, theft requires the intention of permanently deprived, unauthorized use. You don't have your permission at that moment. Mm-hmm. So I agree it's a fine distinction. But again, here, you know, what I keep getting stuck with is there was no harm to these people. There was no reason for them not to be made whole. Mm-hmm. I assume the directors had E&O type insurance, because directors always have E&O type insurance. You know, there was no evidence presented at trial.
That doesn't mean there's no harm, because there's a way they might be able to be made whole.
Well,
it doesn't follow.
It doesn't. And if one of them had said, if the name was used for a personal guarantee, if Mr. Gentle, the pastor of the church, if his name had been used on a guarantee for a loan or something, fine, I gotcha. If there'd been some evidence that the names on that corporate resolution of being Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse and the bank knew who the names of the people that were authorized to sign it, then maybe it's just, you know, I understand that I have a tough row to hoe on this one, but it's just too attenuated, is the appellant's position. It's just too attenuated.
Let's suppose it had just been one officer, so that there isn't the problem that you have a whole bunch of people whose defenses are the same. If just one, you don't think that, even if it ultimately got straightened out as to how this came about, there would not be reputational costs to the person whose identity was misused in this way?
If it was, you know, all the cases cited was using someone's social security number to get a line of credit, using someone's birth certificate to get a passport.
Yeah, I mean, congressmen like to use dramatic examples, right?
No, I'm talking about even in the case law from the other circuits that has been reported. Here you have a squiggle on a signature without a name printed underneath it that purports to be that of a director. So, I mean, how do we quantify what a loss might look like in that situation? You know, in fact, some of the directors testified at the trial in the matter, well, that kind of sort of looks like my signature, but it's above the line or it's over the line. You know, there was no even demarcation. There was no even definitive showing that in this situation there was any potential for harm. None of the names were that distinctive. Charles Ross, you know, I'm sure there's dozens of those. And it's a squiggle on the line that kind of looks like C. Ross or something along those lines. You know, again, I just keep coming back to it's too attenuated for something that carries a 2-year mandatory minimum, consecutive.
You want to talk about your 404B?
Yeah, briefly. Yeah, the test is abuse of discretion, and what we saw is the wire fraud in this case ended in June 08, and Mr. Reynolds took two jobs after that. The first, in terms of testimony, was he was working at a place with a very long acronym, NFPRHA, and he used an Amex, an American Express card to buy personal expenses. After that, there was testimony at a place called Center City Public Charter School, where he worked at for a short period of time, that he said his first paycheck wasn't cash, so they reissued it. And basically both were cashed, and the allegation was there was some attempt to cover up the first check so that it wouldn't be seen in the reconciliation. At the Center City Public School, he paid it back. The testimony was that. And again, Mr. Reynolds testified in this case. Were that brought up on cross-examination when he testified, I'll concede for these purposes that's a loser of an argument. But it was introduced in the government's case in chief. There was a motion in limine. The court decided to admit it. And, you know, we all know the task. We're not forging new law here. It's, you know, whether it goes to motive, absence of mistake, or is pure propensity evidence. The defense in this case was nothing novel. It wasn't under color of law or entrapment by estoppel. It was just, we didn't do it, and they've got to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And that doesn't open the door to propensity evidence. And this, you know, it's very similar in character, which I'll grant you under 404B is not a good thing. But the case law is, you know, Washington is, Braun is a case we said, if he's willing to cheat a little bit over here, why wouldn't he cheat a little bit over there? And that's what this evidence is. The job he took after that, he was using Amex cards for personal expenses. The job he took after that, he was claiming he didn't get paid, and in fact he did get paid, and they issued it again. That's propensity evidence, introduced prior to Mr. Reynolds ever getting on the witness.
But you aren't saying that evidence which could apply to a forbidden purpose and could also apply to a perfectly permissible purpose loses its permissibility because it's introduced before the potential defense that it's answering has been presented.
I'm not saying
the cases aren't with you on that.
What I'm saying is it would have been entirely valid impeachment for Mr. Reynolds had it been brought up.
But you weren't answering my question.
I'm sorry. I'll try again.
Right. That because of the sequence, something that is permissible in it, with relation to a particular defense is impermissible if offered before that defense has been presented.
Well,
the cases are not with you on that.
Well, yes and no. For example, if a statement was suppressed, that couldn't come in the government's case in chief, but if a defendant testified, it absolutely could. Again, that's kind of what I'm getting at with
that. That's a very specific rule on that, and there are specific rules on this, too.
Yes.
Right.
And what I'm saying is, I agree, I'm not saying that were it, what I'm saying, it was introduced and it was entirely impermissible. There could have been specific exceptions to that later, but when it came in the government's case in chief.
Yeah, but you're assuming that there's a different answer to the question that I put to you than the cases give.
Okay. Right? Well, what I'm saying is in this context, it was an abuse of discretion to do so. It was pure propensity evidence. It didn't really relate to anything 404B specific. My time is
and
almost up.
Why don't we hear from the government? We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, sir.
May it please the court. Good morning. John Pigadez on behalf of the United States. It's essentially uncontested at this point on appeal that appellant used the identities of the church officials to obtain a line of credit from the Adams National Bank, which he then converted to his own use, thereby depriving the church of the funds and, in fact, causing harm to the church as a result of his use of those funds. And that essentially makes out all the elements of aggravated identity theft. Indeed, appellant concedes in his brief at page 9, essentially, that the use of the names on the corporate resolution furthered the fraud for which he does not challenge the evidence on appeal. So in our view, and this is entirely consistent with all of the circuits in the country that have considered this question, the government has met its burden of proving every element of aggravated identity theft in this case, and therefore appellant's claim must fail. There is nothing in the language of the statute, nor does legislative history particularly help appellant in this case. And indeed, it's our position you don't even need to get to the legislative history because the language of the statute is plain and clear when you give all of the terms in the statute their ordinary natural meaning. that appellant is guilty of aggravated identity theft as it's defined under the statute. He clearly used the names of the corporate officers. He did so without their legal authority to do so, and he did so in order to perpetuate the crimes of wire fraud and bank fraud, which are two of the enumerated felonies.
Well, they argue no harm.
Well, first of all, harm is not required under the statute, and that's been pretty clear. As a matter of fact, in some of the examples that were we cited in the cases that we cited, there was no harm to the people who were the victims of the aggravated identity theft in those cases. In one case, the person actually sold his means of identifying identification information to the defendant, and there clearly was no harm there, and it wasn't required, the court found. In another case, it was a similar situation of selling an expired passport, and there was no harm. So that's simply not required by the statute, and the cases have so held. In any case, to the extent that one the government would be required to prove harm, there was harm in this case. There was harm to the church and to the bank. And with respect to the church officials themselves, to the extent that they were board officers of this foundation and might in the future need to be required to obtain further loans in order to maintain their church, there certainly was the potential harm of with their names associated with any application for a line of credit or for a loan. So there was that potential harm involved with respect to the defendant's actions. And as far as the case which appellant cites brings the court's attention to the Villanueva Sotelo case, that case and the Supreme Court case were addressing an entirely different issue altogether, and which had to do with the mens rea involved with the statute. Didn't even begin to examine the issue that is raised in this case for the first time on appeal. So we would ask the court to affirm appellant's conviction for aggravated identity theft because the government has fulfilled its obligation to meet all the statutory elements, all the elements to prove that crime. If there are no further questions on the aggravated identity theft, I'd like to turn to the 404B. As the court has pointed out, there was a, just because there's a, where there's a permissible purpose, the fact that it's not propensity evidence. And there was a permissible purpose in this case to admit the evidence. Appellant was charged with two specific intent crimes, wire fraud and bank fraud. The government was required to prove its specific intent. Furthermore, the as the government indicated in its pleadings and its argument before the district court, the government was required to rebut the possibility of mistake or accident, and that's one of the bases on which Judge Kessler admitted that evidence in this case. The government knew going into the trial, just as the government knew in the Brown case, which we've cited, that appellant's defense, to the extent that there was a defense to his actions, was going to be that he believed that he was entitled to a housing allowance and that he believed that he was acting in good faith on the housing allowance that he said he was entitled to, and that if there was any problem at all, it was a mistake for him to rely on what had been told to him from the previous pastor, Jackson, that he had a housing allowance. Now, there was evidence that he never was entitled to a housing allowance in this case. Reverend Jackson and Reverend Gentle both testified that he wasn't entitled to a housing allowance. The other church officials testified that he wasn't entitled to a housing allowance. And indeed, he obtained this quote-unquote housing allowance in an entirely unorthodox way, even by his own admissions, not only at trial, but in his statements to the prosecutor and to the case agent when he was debriefed at the very beginning of this case before any charges were filed. So the government knew going into trial, just as the government knew in Brown, that his defense was going to be a good faith defense, that he was entitled to this housing allowance, and that he had authority to use the corporate American Express card as well as one of the bank's or one of the church's bank accounts for his own purposes. And so this evidence that he did essentially the same thing with an American Express card at the non-for-profit institution, and that he, just as he did at the church, finagled and doctored the records in order to get another paycheck issued to himself at the charter school, were directly relevant to not only his specific intent, but also to absence of mistake or accident and to rebut his good faith defense. So therefore, they were clearly admissible under 404B. As we point out in our brief, appellant in his brief fails to cite any or articulate any prejudice whatsoever with respect to the admission of this evidence. And even now, as he comes here before this court, he cannot articulate.
Well, it's kind of obvious. I mean, you know, you got the two other incidents. I don't think you really want to go there, do you? I mean, that's.
Well, we're talking about unfair, undue prejudice in this case that outweighs, that is outweighed.
Yeah, but there's definitely help out to you, and in that sense.
Of course, to the extent that any evidence that we have proves guilt or helps to prove an element of the case.
Particularly helpful.
It's absolutely prejudicial. We want to introduce prejudicial information.
That's why I stopped you. Okay.
No. Thank you, Your Honor. The point is the unfair prejudice, does it outweigh the probative value? In this case, it does not. And I could give you 10 reasons why it does not, but if there are no further questions, we'll rest on our brief on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again. I just have a couple of points I'd like to make, and then if the court has no questions of me, I'll yield the remainder of my time. The government mentioned mistake or accident and how it was needed to rebut that. I just sat there thinking, I have a hard time thinking in what case that isn't true, in what instance the government doesn't always have to. I suppose there are some specific intent crimes and some general intent where it wouldn't be necessary, but the vast majority of cases, they're always rebutting that, and that doesn't open the floodgates to the things he may have done after he left his.
It may not open the floodgates, but it does mean that the purpose of rebutting contention on that is relevant and present and can be relied on by the court in deciding on admission.
Which brings me to my second point. Even if it cleared the 404B hurdle, it was raised four squarely below 403. You know, whatever probative worth that may have is substantially outweighed by the danger of prejudice. And right here, you know, as you said, Your Honor, the prejudice was enormous. If you're cheating a little bit on that side, why wouldn't you be cheating a bit on the other? So even if you accept it's 404B, I still believe it shouldn't have come in because of 403. The court has no more questions. I will yield the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted.